Earth First activists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney are under arrest.
The white Subaru they were riding in suddenly exploded, blowing out the windows and the driver's door, buckling the roof, leaving burn marks on the roadway.
Today, police say the couple knew they were driving around with a bomb inside.
The evidence strongly points to the fact that they were possessing and transporting that device when it detonated.
Police believe the bomb was being carried in a guitar case owned by Judy Barry.
This edition of Alternative Radio features the radio documentary, Revolutionary Ecology.
On May 24, 1990, a bomb wrapped in nails for shrapnel effect went off under the driver's seat of Earth First activist Judy Barry's car. Judy was nearly killed by the attempted assassination. Her pelvis literally exploded. And it was only through the force of her will that she ever walked again. Fellow Earth Firster Daryl Cherney, who was beside her in the passenger seat, suffered facial cuts and broken eardrums. The FBI terrorist squad arrived on the scene within 25 minutes and framed these nonviolent activists for the bombing that was meant to kill them. One might ask, what brought Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney to the attention of the FBI? The answer lies in the fact that Northern California Earth First had begun to build the first ever coalition between environmentalists and timber workers. Judy Barry was a blue-collar worker and union organizer in Maryland before she moved west, where she raised her children and worked as a carpenter in Mendocino County, California. It was these labor union roots that she brought with her to the struggle to save California's old-growth redwood forests. Judy Barry built bridges across cultural, class, and racial divides. She brought loggers, who had worked these rural lands for generations, together with young idealistic environmentalists who were committed to preventing the destruction of the redwood forest. Workers and environmentalists were poised to take on the timber companies' clear-cut and run logging practices that were destroying not only the forest, but were also jeopardizing the livelihoods of entire working communities. In fact, to the timber companies, this new Logger Earth First Alliance was a declaration of war.
Ain't no place for a face to hide from God in the air.
In 1997, Judy Barry, weakened by two assassination attempts and in constant pain, succumbed to breast cancer and died at the age of 47, leaving behind her two young daughters, Lisa and Jessica. Longtime Earth First organizer Karen Pickett welcomed over 1,000 people to a memorial in Judy Barry's honor at Martin Luther King Jr. School in Berkeley, California.
People talk about Judy, a lot of superlatives keep popping up. David Brower called her an ardent defender of justice, and Holly Neer used the words vibrant and articulate. And you'll hear other words over and over again, like feisty and fiery and funny. Judy was outrageously funny. She was really the queen of the quips. And at a time very shortly after she was bombed, when she was dealing with the tremendous pain and horror of what had happened, she said things like, well, they bombed the wrong end of me. And then later she said, well, I sure hope the FBI finds the bomber and fires him. She was a brilliant strategist, and she had the ability to recognize the point in time to bring in different tactics or different organizing strategies that would change the course of a campaign. And Redwood Summer was a good example of that. And she was the one who recognized that it was the point in time to start doing national mass organizing on the Redwoods issue. Judy was a true revolutionary. She was an in-the-trenches activist who not only made the speeches and raised the money and did the organizing, but she also did the mailings and made the phone calls and took care of all the little details. She was a leader, but she didn't put herself above any kind of work. And speaking of work, we're on the brink of a lot of activity right now. And Judy's case, as many of you know, is closer than ever to trial. We all need to make sure that case proceeds and wins, exposing the FBI's dirty deeds and getting a step closer to find out who bombed Judy Berry. We need to make sure that no more ancient trees and headwaters fall to Charles Hurwitz's axe. We need to make sure that the FBI doesn't get away with their lethal policies of squashing dissident activity. And Judy often said of her fight against the FBI, "This is not about me. This is about activist people everywhere. This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about the Puerto Rican Independentistas. This is about all of us." For that reason, the spirit of Judy Berry lives on in her work and in all of us who carry on that work. Viva Judy Berry.
Cutting down the forest, hauling it away. Rumble of your lumber trucks at the break of day. Last of the baby redwoods, hit that forest floor. Running through your chipper to make your way for Fort LP. 200,000 acres without stopping. Forest to a desert in a day. Modern forestry is so amazing. Let the future generation pay. LP.
In a speech at Humboldt State University, Judy Berry describes Redwood Summer.
Redwood Summer was planned in response to the timber companies having an accelerated cutting schedule. They were cutting faster than they are now because they don't have any trees left there anymore. Headwaters Forest was being threatened. A lot of activists and EPIC and other groups had gotten together a voter initiative called Forest Forever. The timber companies planned on cutting down every tree they could that summer so that the vote would be as moot as possible if it won. So our plan with Redwood Summer was to block every tree from being cut down that we could. The plan was to physically slow them down using nonviolent civil disobedience.
This is a song I wrote for Judy after we were bombed. Even though I was in the car, Judy was the target of that bomb. It was under her seat.
Now Judy Berry is a wobbly organizer, a Mother Jones at the Georgia Pacific Mill. She fought for the sawmill workers hit by that PCB spill. G. Marshall Hunt's calling GP shots from Atlanta. Don Nelson sold in the Union long ago. Now they weren't gonna have no wobbly running their logging show. So they spewed out their hatred and they laid out their scam. Jerry Philbrick called for violence. Was no secret what they planned. So I ask you now, who bombed Judy Berry?
Carl Anthony, president of Earth Island Institute and Urban Habitat.
It is a long journey in time, space, and political consciousness, from the sweltering heat of Noshiba County, Mississippi, where Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman were murdered in 1964 at the beginning of Mississippi summer, to the timber wars of the Pacific Northwest, which led to the car bombing in 1990 of Judy Berry and Darrell Cherney, for their politics of resistance in organizing Redwood Summer. Judy Berry was 15 years old when the militant activist of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee called upon the young people from college campuses to mobilize a massive force of volunteers as field workers in Mississippi to call national and international attention to the voting rights of black sharecroppers in the lowlands of the Deep South. And a quarter of a century later, many people had forgotten the lessons of 1964. To reach the northwest primeval forest from the lowlands of the south, one must traverse the Mississippi bottoms, the sea of grass in the middle states, the high plateau of Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, the great and thirsty American desert, the double rim of the Rocky Mountains and the Pacific Coast ranges. But the journey in political consciousness is perhaps as long and equally complex and torturous. The politics then and now challenge us to reconcile and to reconsider our understanding of rural versus urban, native people versus immigrants, working people versus corporate managers and investors, nonviolence versus violence, the rights of nature versus the prerogatives of people. Judy Barry and her supporters, unlike many of us, made that complex and torturous journey. And she made that journey for those of us who now are left behind. Some of us wanted to believe that we could have social justice and destroy the basis of life on the planet. Others wanted to believe that we could save the trees and tell poor people and working people and the people of color to go to hell. But Judy Barry was different. She taught us that the rights of nature and the rights of working people are cut from the same cloth. In 1990, a group of 150 civil rights organizations sent a letter to the established environmental organizations in this country accusing them of racism. And in January of that year marked the emergence, the public emergence of the environmental justice movement. In the same month, Judy Barry and her colleagues announced a campaign modeled on Mississippi Summer, which came to be known as Redwood Summer. During Redwood Summer, Earth First brought thousands of protesters to the Pacific Northwest to save the primeval redwood forest. The press and the corporations did not want us to know that Judy was inspired by the civil rights movement and that her uncompromising stand to save the trees, that she was also uncompromising in her commitments to the timber workers, to their occupational health and safety, to their rights to participate in the decisions that affect their lives. Corporate leaders wanted us to believe that the choice was between environmental protection and jobs, but Judy knew better. In reality, she taught us that the interests of the timber workers and the interests of environmentalists were one and the same. The real choice was between worship of greed and private profit versus respect for life. In her efforts to bring militant environmentalists and timber workers together, Judy Barry stands on the shoulders of Henry David Thoreau, advocate of the rights of nature, protester against the fugitive slave law. Thoreau, who spent the night in jail in an act of resistance against the Mexican-American War, wrote his famous essay, Civil Disobedience, inspiring Tolstoy, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King. Judy Barry stands on the shoulders of Mahatma Gandhi, who, through nonviolent civil disobedience, led his people from under the shackles of the British colonialism. Judy stands on the shoulders of Martin Luther King, cut down in his prime defending garbage workers. She stands on the shoulders of Chico Mendes, who organized the rubber tappers of Brazil to protect their rights and to save the rainforest. I want to leave with a recollection of an experience that I had of a funeral that occurred when I first came to Berkeley in the early 1970s. It was the funeral of George Jackson, who was killed at San Quentin. And I want to leave you with the words of his mother, who stood in the sun while hundreds of us came to mourn George Jackson, and we waited in line for almost an hour to get to shake the hands of this wonderful woman. And I looked into her eyes, and she looked at me, and she said, "Don't cry, fight."
Gene Lawhorn is a union carpenter and a former mill worker.
My first contact with Judy was through the written word of the industrial worker. I wrote a letter to Judy in answer to an article that she wrote seeking contact with environmental wood products workers. That was around the summer of 89. I had just come back after 5 months on the picket line at Roseburg Forest Products. And sometime in February of 1990, Judy called me to ask me to participate in a panel with her at the University of Oregon's Land, Air, and Water Conference on the subject of bridging the gap between workers and environmentalists. But when Judy approached the panel organizers, she had to threaten to boycott to get me on that panel. That was my first experience with Judy, and her efforts to bust classism within the environmental movement. It was at that conference in March of 1990 that I challenged Earth First activists to renounce tree spiking if they truthfully desired to bridge the gap between workers and environmentalists. To my surprise and everyone else's surprise, Judy Berry stood up and she proclaimed that she agreed with me and hereby renounced the tactic of tree spiking. About a month after the conference, under Judy's leadership, Northern California and Willamette Earth First groups publicly renounced tree spiking in an effort to further reach out to working folks in the timber industry, and thus she made history. She went to the front lines and stood front and center to fight for working people and the ancient forest. To Judy, it was all one struggle, and it was about social justice. She was able to tie the issues of forest protection and workplace justice together like no one else could. And that's why she was bombed, and that's why the FBI attempted to frame her and Daryl Cherney for the bombing. It scared the hell out of the resource extractive industries to think that we as workers and environmentalists might get together to really challenge their power. It's the same way they reacted back in 1877. Latimer, Ward Homestead, Verdun, Ludlow, Everett, Centralia, Matewan, and on to the many other cities and times across this nation when U.S. troops and detective agency death squads massacred working people, their wives, their children, when they dared to fight for better working and living conditions.
Well, I come from a long, long line of tree-falling men. And this company town was here before our grandpappy settled in. We kept enough trees a-standing so our kids could toe the line. But now a big corporation come and bought us out, got us working double time. But tell me, where are we gonna work when the trees are gone?
Judy Berry talks about organizing timber workers during a speech in Portland, Oregon.
What everybody has been asking me for the last 2 days, how do you organize timber workers? How do you organize loggers? How do you get loggers to talk to Earth Firsters? And the first answer is you have to like loggers. That's the first thing. And I already did because, you know, having been a blue-collar worker my whole adult life, the conditions of my life are actually more similar to them than to the privileged environmentalists in the city, the espresso-sucking pavement dwellers, as we call them. But so being from a rural area myself and being a working-class person myself, I can relate for those reasons. A lot of it really depends on your attitude. The thing that happens is people who are more educated or who are from urban areas tend to really look down, especially on rural working people. Actually, what I've discovered from a lifetime of being a non-achiever is that intelligence is equally distributed among the social classes. Dan Quayle is the perfect example of that. But there's a tendency of urban people to look down and consider the timber workers stupid, to talk down to them, to things like that. I've heard a 21-year-old college student say to a 45-year-old logger, "Do you know what biodiversity is?" And, you know, if you do that, that's the end of the conversation. So what I actually do is I just talk to people, that's all. I mean, it's been incredibly easy because there's nobody speaking for the timber workers out there. The wise use movement, the anti-environmentalists, those people are management. In fact, if you actually know them and who they are low-level management. They're fronting for the corporations, but they're not the workers. Nobody's speaking for the workers. The unions have mostly been smashed or corrupted themselves, and the actual interest of the workers is not expressed in the political spectrum in the timber wars. So what I did was, well, one of them is having some respect for them as intelligent human beings. Instead of telling the timber workers what to do, which is the other mistake environmentalists always make, I asked them. And I asked them to tell me about their working conditions and their lives. And the way I would meet them, by the way, is we blockade them. And, you know, here they are, and we're chained to their truck. They're not going anywhere.
And that actually is really how I started meeting timber workers. And, you know, they're kind of curious about these people who are audacious enough to actually hike into the middle of nowhere in the woods and put their bodies on the line. So as I began to hear their stories, and I didn't even do this consciously, I began to give them a forum. By listening to them, by asking them instead of telling them, I really not only learned a lot of wisdom from them, but also began to build this alliance by advocating for the timber workers' issues in the community. And it didn't have to be save the trees. I advocated for workplace issues separately, understanding that it's the same thing, you know, that the workplace issues are neither separate from nor subordinate to the forest issues. They're all part of corporate exploitation of the earth and the people.
Berwyn stole Pacific lumber, used junk bonds to get the cash, left the mighty redwood forest a pile of broken slash. Ivan Boesky made his millions when a Maxam deal was done, $1 billion paid with redwood blood and the workers' pension fund. Maxam's on the horizon, has dollars seen in every redwood tree.
So when the bomb exploded, it was May 24th, 1990, and we were on our way to a concert in Santa Cruz where we were going to play songs and show a slideshow and recruit for a Redwood Summer among the college students there.
Judy Barry in a talk at Humboldt State University.
I can't even describe how horrible it was. I can tell you I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe. But the horror of this experience didn't end with the bombing itself, because within minutes of the bombing, the FBI terrorist squad from the San Francisco FBI office was on the scene. And I literally mean this, within minutes, certainly within a half hour. According to their own records, the first record we have of their being on the scene is a log by the Oakland police. And 25 minutes after the bomb explodes, they recount their conversations with the FBI agents. So they were there pretty fast, considering that this was in Oakland and that FBI office is in San Francisco. And what the FBI did, arriving on the scene immediately, actually my lawyer wrote in the brief, the FBI was there in a trice, almost as if they had been standing around the corner holding their ears. But at any rate, they, whether or not they were standing around the corner holding their ears, they were certainly there quickly. And what they did was they quickly kind of took control of the scene. And they talked to the Oakland police, who were the responding agency. And what they did is they said to the Oakland police, they said, we know these people. These people are terrorists. And literally what they said, this was testified by Sergeant Sitterud of the Oakland police. He said, they told us that these were the kind of people who would carry a bomb. They told us that these people, in fact, qualified as terrorists. With that, the Oakland police were a lot more willing to, they have a long relationship with the FBI anyway, certainly going back to the days of the Black Panthers, and with this stuff being told to them by the FBI, they were willing to cooperate. But it's not just that they accidentally thought that I bombed myself. What we've found is that they told some very, very deliberate lies. And you can't really excuse the Oakland police for going along with it, because these lies were so obvious that anybody with a set of eyes in their head could have seen them. First thing they said, and this was from FBI Special Agent Frank Doyle, and Frank Doyle was their bomb expert on the terrorist squad. So the reasons for the arrest are laid out in the search warrant. And what it says in there is it says, the Oakland police say, I viewed the bombed car along with Special Agent Frank Doyle of the FBI. Frank Doyle informed me that the bomb was on the backseat floorboard, and therefore they should have seen it, and therefore they knew that they were carrying it. Well, years later, as this lawsuit has progressed, we've gotten hold of the Oakland police's own photos. Now, the place where Frank Doyle testified the bomb was right where you put your feet when you're sitting in the back seat. And this, of course, is under the seat. And any idiot could see this. You don't have to be a bomb expert to see that this bomb was not in the back seat. So at that point began an incredible press smear. From the moment that this bomb went off, went an incredible press smear nationwide. It's the only time we ever made the front page of the New York Times. And what this press smear was to to tell people that we were terrorists who had blown ourselves up with our own bomb. Although we can't get anything that we actually do, we can't get it in the newspapers, this one got picked up all over the place. There were selected leaks and innuendos given out by the FBI and the Oakland police in order to convince people that not only are we violent terrorists who carry bombs around in our car, but we're stupid violent terrorists who carry them under our own car seat.
Ed Herman is an economist, media analyst, and co-author with Noam Chomsky of Manufacturing Consent.
The police case, as we know, was built on a lie that an honest media would have uncovered and publicized. But the mainstream media swallowed that lie, and they swallowed the position of the police and the FBI almost uniformly. And their bias in the treatment of the bombing and the underlying issues was blatant. It was so blatant, in fact, that I used the newspaper reports of that time for some years as a case study in a course I gave at Penn on media bias. The New York Times had a front page article by a woman named Catherine Bishop. It's on May 26, 1990. And this article in itself is a beautiful illustration of media bias, and it's worth thinking about, I think. In this article, the police FBI version was totally controlling of the structure of the article. The first subhead of the article had a quote. It said, "meant to be used," unquote. And it meant that the police version was that Barry and Cherney intended to use it. That gets into the quote, and the whole first couple of paragraphs of the article is about the police version that they were transporting the bomb. Then the second heading in the article is called, "Other groups are wary," references to tree spiking and all the negatives that contributed to making it look like this was a dangerous group. The language that was used was also incredibly illuminating. For example, in the very first paragraph, this reporter says, "Supporters of Earth First were, quote, quick to denounce the charges." Police and the FBI were there instantaneously. Never does the author suggest that they were quick to blame the Earth Firsters. No. Here's another beautiful piece of language. "The aim of the Earth First was to, quote, stop the harvesting of old growth redwoods." Now, that is key. It's sort of like you're collecting apples this year from harvesting this year. These 2,000-year-old redwoods, you're harvesting. And later in the article, this reporter further says the tension was rising because of what Earth First was intending to do. Then the same reporter, a couple of weeks later, had another article where she talked about tensions rising because of Earth First's intention to use tactics like sitting in trees. And of course, one fundamental form of bias is that you treat the police and FBI as sacred. This reporter never suggested there's any question of the police and FBI credibility.
Michael Parenti is a noted political writer and the author of History as Mystery and Against Empire.
There's often something important that's left unsaid when commemorating the life of someone like Judy Barry. It's important to speak of her marvelous qualities, her capacity to lead, organize, inspire, and get results. But we must also say something about the price she paid at the hands of our enemies. Alexander Coburn begins the column he wrote on her in The Nation with, quote, "Cancer nailed poor Judy Barry," unquote. Putting aside the insensitive phrasing by Alexander, cancer didn't nail her. The repressive state killed her, I believe. They subjected her to death threats and assaults. They ran her car off the road, then set off a bomb under her car seat that tore and mangled her previously vibrant, healthy body, causing lasting damage to her health and her immune system. From then on, she lived in serious pain and discomfort, and her health became a more tenuous thing. She was subjected to the additional stress of being charged with the very crime that was committed against her.
That's the radio documentary, Revolutionary Ecology. And this is Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program by calling toll-free 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.